Hello and welcome back to the hostile environment that is Romaniacs. It's been a wild week in Brexit land. We've had the forced resignation of the Home Secretary, a series of defeats for the government in the Lords, including one that our own Ian Dunt said could easily prove to be one of the most important amendments in post-war British history, and Jeremy Corbyn whipping the Labour Lords to abstain from an amendment that would have made a final say vote possible. I'm Dorian Linsky. I've got two of our regulars with me. Naomi Smith is Chief Operating Officer at Best for Britain and a frontline Remainer, although she's here in a personal capacity. Hi, Naomi. How are you?
Yeah, I'm good, thank you.
As a seasoned campaigner, did you enjoy the Conservatives' local election leaflet in Ilford with a memorable heading, "What we're doing / have done for ward / area name"?
Oh, my goodness. So this is a leaflet that has gone out under the candidate Mona Hassan's name. So this is, yeah, Ilford Town is about as much as we know about this leaflet. And it's just number one issue we've done, number two issue we've done, with lots of holding text. I feel sorry for the agent that is, you know, probably whose head's going to roll for this. But wowza. I mean, yeah. Well, of Conservatives course, really not working very hard at all in that ward for those elections.
Of course, ward / area name is a key battleground. And why don't we listen to the valid issues / concerns for voters in ward / area name? And propose policies / solutions.
They are against bad things and in favour of good things.
Well, we hope you all enjoy this show / podcast. Also, with this is Ian Dunt, editor of politicsco.uk. How are you doing, Ian?
Hello, very well.
We're going to do the Lord stuff in numbing detail later. But was that amendment?
You sound like you're not looking forward to it.
I'm psyched. But was that amendment really the most important one since the Second World War?
It could be if the Commons backs it up and if we reject the motion that comes back from the withdrawal bill. I mean, if either of those two things don't happen, then no, it's a complete irrelevance. But if both of those things happen, then yeah, what you're doing is you're sort of strapping the government into Parliament's control for the most important decision that it will ever take. So it almost, the thing is, you can cheat quite a bit by saying the most important X in the post-war era, because the way in which we're so legislatively wrapped up in the EU, any decision you made around that undoes the last 30 years of law. So it sort of by default is the most important thing there. And in this case, if those two things hold, that Commons vote and that we reject the motion, in that case, yeah, it would be.
Cool. And if listeners haven't had enough of the Lords versus the Government Infinity War, Ian is also appearing on our sister podcast Big Mouth this week talking about Avengers Infinity War. What's the...
I know you're going to fucking do it.
Here it comes. Choo-choo! What's the Brexit angle on Infinity War, Ian?
I know. You always fucking do. Like, it's every time there's like a comics thing, you're like, what is the Brexit? So I don't know, man. There is no connection between those two things. There's nothing.
But he's UKIP purple.
Yeah, fucking, here we go.
He thinks there should be fewer people. Producer Andrew is nodding. He thinks this is a great idea.
Producer Andrew is convinced that Thanos is Brexit. That just seems like kind of overdoing it, even from a Remainer point of view. They're not trying to kill half the population.
Look, also the Venn diagram of our listeners and you know, comic enthusiasts and things like this is probably not quite as great as it might be.
It remains about five people, but we serve them very well.
You do. You
it's
do.
Basically a diagram of Andrew's brain. Before we get into all that, and Ian, you really let the team down there. It's an amazing double guest show this week. Later in the show, we'll be talking to Billy Bragg, who popped into the studio last week with his guitar to talk about where Brexit came from and what he thinks we can do to stop it and address the concerns that led to it. But first, we're delighted to break our year-long run of old people on the show by welcoming an actual young person onto Romaniacs. Femi Oluwole is the co-founder of Our Future, Our Choice, the youth campaign for a democratic escape from Brexit, otherwise known as OFOC. Femi left a year-long internship at the EU Agency for Fundamental Rights in Vienna to fight for a new referendum, People's Vote, on Brexit. He was enraged and frustrated that the arguments against Brexit weren't being put properly, so he decided to do it himself. Hi, Femi. Welcome to Romaniacs.
Hi. How are you? Not too bad. Not too bad. Yourself?
Good.
By the way, I am a massive Marvel fan, so I think...
Six people.
Six, yeah.
I think it definitely... There's definitely tie-ins to Brexit. It is a man driven by a very, very extreme ideology who's willing to push it ahead against the will of most people just purely because that he thinks it's the right thing and it's going to result in a lot of suffering for everyone. And he's choosing half of existence over another, which is pretty much the Brexit vote. I can definitely see significant parallels between Thanos and Jacob Rees-Mogg.
You did a much better job of that than I did.
I have to hand it to you.
That's a big hello to our new co-host, Femi. Thanks, Ian. See you later. So what made you want to quit that job? It was obviously something, you know, a very good job, something you really believed in as well, to kind of take time out from that path and take on the sort of responsibility of fighting Brexit.
Well, with great power comes great responsibility. My background is EU law, I've just seen my country be lied to on just the basics of EU law and sent in a completely new direction that 9 out of 10 experts say will harm it permanently, which does create a degree of responsibility on my part to actually do something about it. I have skills in terms of advocacy and my background is EU law, so I should be out there setting the record straight. So things about democracy, things about EU immigration, things about basically the fundamentals of the decision that was made two years ago, I've been trying to correct that since.
But you've been doing a lot more than that, because that is sort of putting out facts, which actually, you know, they may have done a few things badly, but the Strong Green campaign did keep pumping out facts, and that didn't sway anyone. So that's not all you've been doing. Actually, no. You know, tell us a bit more about the story that you tell.
Well, having dealt with Farage on several occasions on his show and having pumped out the facts, I realised that, yeah, more needed to be done. And so around October last year, I created Our Future, Our Choice as just basically a separate Twitter account, because I needed to make a different argument. I need to make an emotional argument. And the strongest emotional argument related to Brexit is your kids do not want this future. They do not want the future that's being forced on them by Brexit. Do not do that to them. Because, quite frankly, they will resent the people that put them in that position, because they're the ones who are going to be looking for jobs in that economy. They're the ones who are going to be trying to raise families in that economy, paying for mortgages in that economy. They will resent everything that went before if you don't at least give them a chance to stop this.
And I interviewed you for a piece I did for The Guardian last Saturday about the People's Vote campaign and the general movement to stop Brexit. And you made this point that sort of demographically, it's really not long before the country becomes majority Remain.
Yeah.
So that in terms of like the will of the people and the mandate, it's actually quite time limited.
Yeah, the will of the people argument literally has an expiration date, and that expiration date is December 2020/2021, because, and that's been calculated by the Financial Times, Peter Kellner, the pollster, and UK and the Changing Europe, that by the time we have and exit the transition period, by the time Brexit actually happens, it's directly against the will of the people. So calling this a democratic success is a fallacy, because, quite frankly, it's anti-democratic, because it's anti the people.
And what would you say to people who would counter that with, oh, but, you know, for every 16-year-old and 17-year-old turning 18, you've got some people who are sort of, you know, becoming middle-aged and later who become more right-wing or become, you know, more protectionist in their worldview, switching from Remain to Leave?
This wasn't so much a left versus right thing. This was more, it wasn't really, I mean, there were people on the left who thought Brexit was a good idea. There were people on the right who thought Brexit was a bad idea. The issue here is, did you believe that Brexit would economically harm the country? Do you feel both European and British? And simply, if you were born after 1974, then the only adult identity that you've ever known, because of the timing of the Maastricht Treaty, is being both a British and an EU citizen. That is a generation that has only ever known themselves as both British and EU citizens. That's not going to change in a couple of years, because it's the only identity they've ever had. So all we're going to have now is more people who've only ever felt that way getting the right to vote. And I think, quite frankly, the fact that 16-year-olds were excluded from the referendum, I'm sorry, they are economically active. They're a group of people that that are working and contributing to the economy, and yet they don't have a say over the economy of this country. That is taxation without representation. That is, it's unfair.
Yeah, I agree with you.
There's all this energy behind kind of, a difficult task, which is securing the people's vote. If that was secured, do you think there is any chance that 16, 17-year-olds would be given the vote? Is that something that you think is attainable, or is it more just a principle you want to restate?
A bit of both. I think we need to state that principle to put pressure on Parliament to say this should have been given to the 16-year-olds in the first place. Do it now. Correct your mistake.
I saw Ofoc on stage in Leeds at that protest march. One of your co-founders had voted Leave, and had obviously quite dramatically changed his mind.
Yeah.
And you know, you tweet out a lot of videos where you're talking to leavers, and I know that Best for Britain, talks about this a lot, which is like, how do you create a dialogue? What have you learned? What seems to be the most sort of fruitful pathways, and also what turns them off? What kind of brings the barriers down?
Okay, well, the positive way to do things is firstly recognizing that we all wanted the same things in general. We wanted a better NHS. We wanted the UK to be strong. We wanted to have a fairer society. Those are things that are common to both Brexit voters and Leave voters. The moment we forget that, that's when we have a massively divisive politics in this country. We have to remember that. So when you go to them and say, all right, what did you want? You wanted a stronger and more influential Britain. Well, look at the deal that Theresa May is striking right now. It means that for the first 2 years of Brexit, we'll be following the rules of the EU, but we would have given up our seat at the table in deciding those rules. That makes us, by definition, a less sovereign country. And when you ask them that, what do they say? That's disgusting. That's not what we voted for at all. And people, there's this misconception that Remainers are happy to give up sovereignty, that we want the UK to be weak. No, we want to be at the table deciding the laws of Europe. And when you point out to Brexiters that Brexit is resulting as being less sovereign, they're on your side. They wanted a strong country, and Brexit is going the other direction. And the most reassuring from a Remain standpoint thing is that when I ask Brexit voters, how do you think the negotiations are going? They say terribly. When I ask them if the negotiations result in a Brexit deal that makes us less sovereign or less well off, do you think the people, the British people, deserve a right, have the right to have a say on that deal? They say yes. Brexit voters, I mean, that's the thing. Right now, there is an 8-point lead in favour of a final say or a chance for the people to review the deal. But that gets compared with, and this is where we get to what turns people off, there is a majority against the term second referendum. And that makes absolute sense. Why? Because nobody, myself included, wants a repeat of 2016. Nobody wants a situation where we're made to vote on something where everyone was able to say, well, Brexit might mean this, Brexit might mean this, Brexit might mean this. No. In October, we will have an actual draft treaty. You'll be able to see line by line in black and white, what does Brexit mean? How will it affect the country? Will we be following the rules of the EU? Will we have the same access to the European market? Those are things that will become certainties at the end of this year. So second referendum, bad. Vote on the final deal, a final say, a people's vote. That's what people want.
You're out there actually talking to people, and I don't like talking to people. No, but when I'm on, you know, if you're on social media, indeed, if you're just kind of, you know, watching Newsnight, listening to the Day programme, it's very adversarial. You know, the Leave voters that are likely to kind of, you know, come at me on Twitter are not generally a reasonable bunch. Do you feel that there's a kind of, that the impression that we get, perhaps through both the media and social media, of this kind of bitterly polarized country is actually how much of that do you see or not see when you're going out there actually talking to people?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, I've started to like people a little bit more since I came off social media and actually started talking to people in real life, because social media people are bad people.
Sometimes they're not even people. Yeah.
Bad people. I say that knowing that I spend my time on social media. Everyone is a worse version of themselves on social media. In real life, when you talk to just reasonable Brexit voters whose guiding star is what is best for this country, when you point out to them that this isn't going the way that they planned, that it's going to end up with a country that's less sovereign and less well off, when you point out to them that the areas that voted strongest for Leave, like the Northeast, for example, are going to be the worst hit by Brexit, when what they wanted was a more balanced country, and in fact, you're just basically rebalancing the country in favour of London and in favour of Westminster, they're on your side, because they're rational. But whereas on social media, I mean, you only pipe up if you disagree with something. So you're automatically going to get the most confrontational people imaginable speaking to you.
One more thing I wanted to ask about OFOC is obviously very good acronym. But then another group came along for our future's sake with FFS, which seemed a little cheeky, lively with the acronym front. Can you, because there's a lot of these groups out there, and obviously I've tried to kind of explain what they all do. What's you're both sort of talking to young voters. What's the difference in your kind of your sort of backgrounds and remits, the two groups?
Well, Our Future, Our Choice, we tend to make the youth argument more generally, as in, for us, youth is the generation that voted Remain, and that's everyone under 60. If you take under 60s in the country as a group, we voted to Remain. So we're speaking for youth in a very broad sense.
Does that mean we're young now?
That means you're young. It means you've just been
you
rejuvenated
can definitely
by Brexit.
Back on the podcast anytime.
I feel better already. My back stopped hurting.
I literally feel older now.
And FFS, they are primarily student mobilization, which is absolutely necessary. Because one of the most troubling things that we see is that people are just as anti-Brexit as they always were. Especially young people. They think this is an absolute disaster. The problem we're finding is, yes, they think it's a disaster, but they've been bashed over the head with Brexit is happening, Brexit is happening, Brexit is happening. And so it's about pointing out to them that there is a way that this can be stopped, that in October there is going to be a vote in Parliament as to whether or not the Brexit deal is acceptable. And at that point, a Parliament that majoritarily believes that it would harm the country can then pass it back to the people in order to wash their hands of it so they don't get blamed. So Brexit can be stopped that way.
So on the broad remit of OFOC, I think what we know works well and what did work a little bit in the referendum campaign, but we didn't do enough of, was this appealing to the older generation. So kids talking to their parents, parents talking to grandparents, that kind of thing. So how much of that are you doing? How are you helping other young people to have those conversations with their families?
One of the things that I try to remember is try to communicate is that you don't need to convince your parents that remaining in the EU is the best thing ever. Mm. All you need to say is, Mum, Dad, please don't do this to me. I will be living with this for the rest of my life. It changes my identity. It removes my Europeanness from me. It will affect my relationship with the rest of the continent. It affects my ability to live and work in the rest of the continent. Right now, as Brits, we have the birthright to live and work in any country we choose across 31 countries across Europe. And that's what Brexit is taking from us. Please do not cut off my opportunities in life. Please do not give me a future that I actively voted against and do not want. So I respect that I may never change your views, but please don't do this to me. That argument, I believe, will
very
resonate.
Very, very powerful, yeah.
Thanks, Femi. I'll be helping us through the woods of Brexit in the rest of the show. But before we get there, a few very quick reminders. Firstly, Britain is going to the polls this week, and it's incredibly important that you have your democratic say that so many have fought and died for. By which, of course, we mean voting for Remainiacs in the Listener's Choice category at the British Podcast Awards. Just go to britishpodcastawards.com/vote and enter Remainiacs. You could win two tickets to the event and be showered with champagne when Ed Miliband beats us yet again. And the ghost of the Pankhursts will smile down on you for exercising your democratic right.
He's been trying to get listeners to photo their vote, and then they'll take them to the show if they win it. They're going to pick a name out of a hat.
What is this bullshit?
That's called treating under electoral commission law.
Quite.
Yeah. Mm. He just can't stop, can he? He's just like...
He fucked up the Labour membership system. Now look at what he's done.
Oh, he likes, winning. He likes winning now, doesn't he? Oh, it's all win, win, win. Secondly, if you enjoy the show, and why wouldn't you, then remember you can support Remainiacs via the crowdfunding platform Patreon. Pledge us a few pounds every month and you'll get smart mugs, t-shirts, bags and a priceless sense of being on the right side of history. Go to patreon.com/remainiacscast to find out more. And finally, if you're not all podcast doubt yet, the second episode of Anger Management with Nick Clegg is available now. Produced by our backroom team and hosted by the former Deputy Prime Minister, it's a fortnightly look at the age of rage and how we get reason back on top. Nick's guest this week is George Osborne. And we hear they recorded the show standing up in a power stance for the whole hour. It's quite a listen. You can find Anger Management with Nick Clegg on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher and all your favourite podcast apps. OK, let's get into the week in Brexit. First up, the House of Lords continues to beat the government like a dirty carpet. This week, peers voted to kill off the prospect of any no-deal Brexit by enabling Parliament to force the government to reopen negotiations with the EU if David Davis's deal is voted down. This was the ninth, count 'em, defeat that the government had suffered in the Lords over the withdrawal bill. The rage of Brexiters was a beauty to behold, with disgraced former Defence Secretary Liam Fox claiming the Lords were thwarting the will of the British people, and the Mail calling the Lords a house of unelected wreckers, which sounds like a great Electroclash record from 2002. House of unelected wreckers! But it wasn't all good news for Remainers. A Lib Dem amendment calling for a final say referendum was defeated when the Labour front bench abstained, much to the fury of people who observe these things closely, like Ian. Ian, we mentioned a little bit the implications here. Does the sort of rebelliousness of the Lords in general indicate a real sea change in Brexit? Because it seems like the Brexiters are very worried.
Yeah, they are. It's also interesting to note how little they have to
use in their arguments. Like, if you heard Liam Fox on the Today programme this week.
Oh, yeah.
It's like a fucking broken toy. Like, he has the one phrase, just as you're thwarting the word of the people, and he just repeated it in various formulations over and over. I actually thought he'd been psychologically broken.
And he was one of the most vociferous voices against any House of Lords reform. Mm. And is now criticising.
Like, oh, my God, seeing all these Tories rush out going, well, the first thing we need to do...
abolish the Lords.
They've gone a bit mad because they're like, call their blood. Call another election.
Yeah.
And then abolish the House of Lords. And it's like, what? Mm. You know, maybe that's what happens when you're psychologically broken.
They are in trouble here because the Lords are... They're probably going further than I thought. I was expecting maybe sort of 10 things would come back to the Commons. I think we're probably going to end up with more than that. But also, it's more of a sort of attitudinal thing. They're looking bullish. They're looking like they don't care. In the same way that those Tory rebels look like they started owning the concept of being a rebel MP after that vote in December on Dominic Grieve's amendment. Now, you start putting these things together, and I think you get something quite interesting. Dominic Grieve's amendment was very, very effective in cutting off ministers' ability to use statutory instruments going up to the withdrawal bill. Statutory instruments sort of basically turn ministers into little mini parliaments, just being able to do whatever they like. And he started cutting off their ability to do it on that side. This starts saying, this is what happens if a series of three conditions aren't met. What happens, the consequence, is that parliament takes control. It takes control over from the government, says, we can dictate to you what you do next. The three conditions are basically, do they come back with the motion? They've put dates on this stuff. So, I mean, they need to come with the withdrawal agreement to the Commons by November the 30th, 2018. You need a royal assent on an act of Parliament by January 31st, 2019. And you need a withdrawal agreement between the UK and the EU27 by February 28th, 2019. Now, that last part is crucial because what that last part does is it says there can be no deal.
Yep.
You cannot afford to not have a deal. And if you do come back with no deal, if there's no deal by that point, Parliament takes back control. It also means on the first of those three that if they were to vote down that resolution, Parliament then again takes control. Mm. Now, the reason this is so important is because we know there is that black hole of chaos that goes from the autumn to the spring if we vote down that proposition in Parliament. Now, what this does is start to put parliamentary control around it. When we start talking about another referendum, this is a key thing. You can imagine lots of people there in Parliament going, not very happy with this. The thing's been voted down, but the only possible way I can see of making any progress, and you could see Brexiters and Remainers making this point, is to go, well, look, then I guess we're going to have to throw it open to the country. And that suddenly becomes a much more viable and credible option than it may seem right now.
When I spoke to James McGorry at Open Britain, he said that one of the problems that the Remain side as it is now has is how to portray your opponents, which is, are they fanatics? Are they reckless? Are they incompetent? And he says, they're all three, but it's really hard to say to voters that someone can be all of those things. Because you think, well, fanatics are normally quite competent.
Are they?
They're going to be quite organised. People associate, I mean, many fanatics in history have not. They've been terrible. But you know what I mean? It's hard to kind of get that message across that they're kind of scary, but they're also useless.
Well, I mean, you've got Jacob Rees-Mogg, who's both competent and a fanatic. And then you've got people like David Davis, who just doesn't seem to care about anything.
Given up. He's checked out.
Yeah, I mean, the absolute cavalier attitude, just so relaxed that he gives when he's before the select committees, it's painful that he can. I mean, this is a while ago now, but when he sat in that select committee and said, "All right, so David Davis, so have you got an impact assessment on this sector? No, this sector, no." Oh, you can just assume that I haven't got any for any of them. What? You are in charge of this whole process. You literally are telling us that you not only don't know how Brexit would affect us, but don't really care?
I also think we don't have to worry too much about painting them as anything, because I think they do a pretty good job of it themselves. Mm. And also, as Remainers, the people we've got to convince actually aren't really watching Newsnight and listening to the Today programme and hearing any of this, right? So that's a sort of slight... It's something that you need to think about, but if we want to win that meaningful vote and then win the referendum, but people say, you've got to do that. So, I mean, my message to everybody is that you've got to keep writing to your MPs on this. Mm. That's what matters. So don't get too distracted about painting anyone as anything. And you can, obviously, every listener should sign up for bestofbritain.org if they want to find out, updates on what's...
Is she operating in a peer personal capacity right now?
Yeah, totally personal. But,
asking for a friend.
But on the amendments, I think the meaningful vote amendment will go through the Commons. So that amendment that's come down from this, I think that probably will go through. But we cannot be complacent about it. And don't get sort of sidetracked by, oh, we've got to paint people as sort of incompetent villains or fanatical villains or whatever. Write to your MP.
But I think you're right.
Make them vote that through.
It's almost like the hardline Brexiters, they're almost acting as if nobody outside a very small group is paying attention. Mm. Because Jacob Rees-Mogg wrote this remarkable piece about, in sort of praise of Trump and going, Trump is Brexit Britain's best friend. And you think that anybody who was kind of like reading the room would not be the most toxic politician on the world stage on your side. And so it seems actually that there's the argument that's happening among these people is not directed at voters.
There is a serious disconnect between the proponents of Brexit, the loudspeakers like Farage and Jacob Rees-Mogg, and the actual voters of Brexit. Mm. And what the most infuriating thing that I regularly hear from the loud voices is, Brexit voters are happy to be economically worse off as long as they get Brexit. That is the fundamentalists like Jacob Rees-Mogg claiming that all Brexit voters are just as fundamentalist as he is. No, Brexit was a vote that came from people who have been screwed over by the system, who are very much struggling to get by, who thought that Brexit was going to make their lives better. To then argue that they're okay being worse off for ideological reasons, that's the disconnect. Mm. And it's just not okay that the politicians who, let's face it, Jacob Rees-Mogg, privileged, Nigel Farage, privileged, Boris Johnson, privileged, these are the people claiming that the people who've been disadvantaged are okay being more disadvantaged for their ideology.
Well, yesterday, I think we had, Tuesday, there was Douglas Carswell, Charterhouse old boy and former fund manager, raging against the establishment and the elites. He was one of the people that thought that Theresa May should call the Remainers, call the rebels bluff and call an election and crush the saboteurs.
That went really well last time.
That went really well last time. Second time lucky. But for me, there was a vote for the amendment proposed on the final say on this people's vote, which with Labour front benches, it would have passed. I know that this is kind of like this has become a kind of weekly theme on the show. How do you feel about, particularly if you're talking about, you know, demographics here, and obviously young voters are vastly favour Labour. Is the Labour position more frustrating with each week, or do you feel that optimistic that it's sort of turning in a good direction?
Labour has been the most frustrating part of this for me, because Jeremy Corbyn should be my idol. I mean, my background is human rights. He's one of the few people that's really, really championing human rights and always has done in the UK Parliament. I am very much for economic fairness. I am for pretty much everything that Jeremy Corbyn believes in. But on Brexit, he seems to be dropping the ball significantly. He has said plainly that he knows that Labour voters and Labour members are overwhelmingly pro-EU. That his fan base, his people that put him in office, put him in his position right now, are pro-EU. And he said in the 2017 elections that he is about he was elected to give a voice to his members and voters. Yet he's not doing that. He knows that his voters are pro-EU. He knows that the people that put him there are pro-EU. And yet, despite the fact that Brexit already fails his six tests, one of which is that we need to have all the same economic benefits as both single market and customs union, despite the fact that Brexit fails his own tests, he's not saying what he's going to do about it. I understand that it's difficult for Jeremy Corbyn to come out and simply say, I oppose Brexit. Brexit must be stopped. That would be difficult for him. But he doesn't need to do that. All he needs to do is say, I will protect you, the British people, from any Brexit deal that doesn't meet my tests, that will leave you worse off by allowing you, the British people, to vote on it. That's all he needs to say. It means he doesn't need to oppose Brexit himself. And even when the referendum comes, he doesn't need to pick a side. All he needs to say is, if it doesn't meet my tests, the people need to vote on it in order for this to go ahead. But he's not doing that.
Ian, could you game this out for us? Like, if this had passed and then it went to the Commons, would the Commons be able to reject a vote, a people's vote?
Of course.
Yeah.
They would have.
Yeah.
You think they would have? Wouldn't the optics of that be pretty bad?
No. I think they could have gotten away with that pretty easily. To me, the time is not now. I would have obviously put that thing forward and I would have voted for it if it was in front of me and all of that. If there is another referendum
It is going to happen because it is enough of a least bad option for sufficiently high number of people. It's not going to happen because all the people who believe in it want it to take place.
Yeah.
It'll be because it's an insurance policy for both sides of the debate. And that is the context in which it will take place. It's just not going to happen now. And if it had come to the Commons, they would have rejected it by a much higher margin than it got rejected by the Lords.
Which was an argument doing the rounds in the Remain camp last week. It was, do we push hard to get the Lords to vote this through or not? Because is the Commons ready to accept it yet? And there was a pretty strong feeling amongst the Remain movement that the Commons was not ready yet to be. So we need to do much more work, like as Femi is doing, getting public opinion changed to give strength to the Commons to vote it through.
Yeah, it's always worth firing off the shot. You know, I mean, they did the right thing by chucking it up there. It was just, I don't think anyone really expected it to get through, and it wouldn't have gone anywhere even if it had.
Ian, what did we make of the Brexit Ultra's latest ultimatum to May over the idea of a customs partnership? It's just one in a series of ultimatums.
Yeah, it's just them. I mean, they are fucking off their tits. So the customs partnership itself is total lunacy. It makes no sense on any possible basis. The fact that they're going to die in a ditch over this actually tells you something interesting psychologically about where they're at. They are right now in this war cabinet. They love the shit of the ideas, the more extraordinary and military and sexy the names become around the whole thing. They have the same with MaxFac, maximum facilitation, which really means we won't check the lorries. that's really what that means. And hybrid, which is the customs partnership thing, which is just total nonsense.
Is it apprentice team name brainstorming?
Exactly, yeah. I mean, at the end of it, it's a rotten tomato. Like, that's what ultimately what you get. So this idea was when they put forward in a position paper on the customs union last autumn. They presented it to Brussels. Brussels said, no, you're off your rocker, mate. You can fuck off. None of it works on any basis whatsoever. Imagine that you're going to basically say to the EU, we're going to have one customs sort of border. If it's 10%, say the UK's got 10% on tomatoes, EU's got 8% on tomatoes. Canada sends us a tomato. You then charge them to 10%. You send the tomato ends up in Barcelona somewhere. Somehow you know that it's ended up in Barcelona. Then you pay the other 2% back to Canada. Now just imagine, there's only two. There are two ideas for this. Was to use a tracking mechanism, the likes of which have not been invented yet.
What, on the tomato?
I don't want to eat a microchip.
Presumably,
tomato.
Can all the fucking tomatoes? Yeah, no.
Right, we've turned you off veganism.
That needs to be.
I might take a chlorinated.
I wouldn't eat a microchip to tomato.
Yeah, exactly.
I might go for a chlorinated chicken over that. No.
Or you can have the receipt. So wherever it gets sold, you'd then take that receipt and send it over to the government, claim back that. I mean, imagine that. And this is on products that you can see it go all the way through. Imagine if it's something like sugar, where the sugar comes in, certain tariff rate. You then put the sugar in a cake. You sell the cake on somewhere outside the country. That's a different tariff rate. Just try to imagine the degree of complexity and completely bonkers and bureaucratic nonsense that you'd be dealing with there. And this is the government position, which the Brexiters are now attacking. But of course, they don't need to attack it because no one in Brussels was going to accept the thing in the first place. So the fact that they are in a room right now, in the closing stages of Brexit, arguing over an imaginary proposal which no one would ever actually put down, is the most beautiful demonstration of where they have ended up. They've got no ideas. They've got no idea of how to deal with the problem that Brussels has presented them with on the backstop. And therefore, they are in that room with Theresa May losing their minds.
Cast your mind back to the misty, distant past of last Sunday night when someone finally took responsibility for Theresa May's hostile environment policy and the Windrush scandal. That person was, of course, not Theresa May, but Amber Rudd, who at least had the decency not to resign 5 minutes after we'd recorded a podcast. May replaced her with Sajid Javid instead. We've been through all the politics of this, but what are the implications for Brexit, if any?
I think this is a bit of a difficult one to call because we know at his heart he is a proper Brexit sympathiser, but he's also sort of a ruthlessly pragmatic kind of person as well. And I think he's going to, recognise that complete fucking car crash that is probably happening right now, as Ian just explained. The resignation barely disguises the fact that the Tories are now in a very powerless position. Theresa May has been, as you mentioned, exposed as the true architect of these deportation policies, and that isn't going to be resolved by rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic.
He's also like a big old Ayn Rand fan who reads out his favourite scene twice a year or something. Ian, it said that Rudd was a moderating voice in cabinet. She was, sort of holding May back from the worst excesses, a sort of secret, very secret liberal. But you wrote a piece saying that there wasn't any evidence for that.
Yes, it's just funny, isn't it? Because, I mean, it's been 18 months or so that everyone writes these op-eds, perpetual op-eds about how she's the liberal conscience of the government. And she's just like, It's been 18 months now. There was never any fucking evidence for it in the first place. There's no evidence for it now. She's done nothing that we can see. In fact, all of the private communication that we can see between her and May was the most horrific, draconian, authoritarian nonsense of the highest order. And then we get presented with, oh, but, you know, but don't worry, I'm sure she's whispering into her ear coming up with a more sort of pragmatic Brexit policy. And you're like, well, where is the more pragmatic Brexit policy? The last time I saw, they were still pursuing the kind of complete nonsense we spent the last half an hour describing. So on that basis, I can't really see what we've lost. We may potentially have gained someone on the backbenches who's willing on those very tight votes to go against. I mean, Naomi's making a sceptical face, and I think you're right to, in that I'm not sure that we will. I can't see her voting for a customs union.
Greening and Morgan were sort of sacked. It felt much more like a genuine resignation than a sacking. I didn't get the sense, in the same way I did with the others, that there's bad blood, particularly between May and Rudd, and she might be thinking about a comeback at some point. And so I just don't want to bank that one yet as somebody that will become a Tory rebel on those key votes.
And do we think Rudd leaving kind of, you know, manages to sort of staunch the wound of this scandal? Or is it going to roll on?
It shouldn't, but it probably will, because that's the way the pack operates. As you know, there's a scalp, there's a kind of a closure, and off you go. I mean, this stuff has been going on for years. You know, this is about turning people into border guards, basically to get them to report to the state their own neighbours. That policy is not going anywhere. There's been no attempt to change it. I mean, Sajid Javid is changing the branding, although he's not even really doing that, because the compliant environment stuff was actually stuff that Rudd changed the branding for. So I very much doubt this is the end of it happening. I imagine it is the end of us talking about it, and that'll be the big tragedy.
Just to put this whole Windrush thing into concrete Brexit terms, EU migrants make up 5% of our population, 10% of our doctors, which means that EU immigration is keeping the NHS afloat. And since the Brexit vote, we've seen doctors leaving, nurses leaving, we've seen nurse registration from EU countries drop, and 1 in 5 doctors plans to leave. So this government, which is tasked with keeping the NHS alive, had one job. Show EU migrants, show migrants from other countries that they are welcome, that they will be treated with respect, and that their rights will be protected. Windrush. That is a failure. So EU migrants, EU doctors that would be considering registering here or considering leaving have been shown that if we don't think you're British enough, we might send you away. And that applies to your friends, that applies to your kids, it applies to your future generations who won't necessarily be doctors but will still be living here. If we don't think you're British enough, your rights aren't really protected because you're not really the ones we're looking out for. That's the message that we sent. So the NHS in Brexit is just going to get worse.
You almost couldn't have asked for it to be a more direct comparison, could you? I mean, the Windrush was defined by, you don't worry, you don't need the documents, there's exemptions for you in law, it'll be fine. 50 years later, it turns out it's not so fine. Mm-hmm. And exactly the same with EU citizens. Mm-hmm. Don't worry, you're here under free movement, exactly as they came under free movement. Mm-hmm. Exemptions for you, don't need to worry about it. Maybe it turns out that later on it won't be so fine, and Brussels has certainly taken notice of that.
And it was those Windrush generation people that were staffing our NHS when they came over. You know, lots of people had Jamaican midwives. Yeah, I mean, exact direct comparison.
This country's terrible.
It's increasingly the realisation that we're going to do.
Finally, a small follow-up on something from last week's show with David Lammy. Listener and accidental tariff nerd. I love the idea that you can become one accidentally. Jim Cornelius.
Believe me, you can.
Oh no, what's happened? I know all about tariffs. Jim Cornelius tweeted us with some fascinating and really deep EU trade stuff. Jim told us, you said that the UK turned its back on the Commonwealth when it joined the EEC, then David spoke of the EU impoverishing Caribbean banana growers. But, Jim explains, in the original Treaty of Rome, the colonies of the founding nations had associate membership of the EEC with tariff-free access. When Britain joined, African, Caribbean and Pacific former colonial nations, or ACP countries, including ours, got preferential access to EEC markets. And the whole thing was only overturned when banana giants, another good phrase, like Dole and Del Monte complained to the WTO that those nations were getting preferential treatment from the EU while Latin America didn't. Let's go to the next Avengers movie, Avengers Banana Giants. Eventually, the Caribbean ACPs acquired new agreements which gave them duty-free and quota-free access to European markets for all goods starting in 2015. So, from all this, we can conclude two things. One, we got it a bit wrong. And two, we have the smartest listeners on the planet, and Jim Cornelius is Remainer of the Week. So, fair point. He checked our facts for us.
Don't anyone else start getting the idea that that's something they should do on a regular basis. We'd be fucked.
Generally, just assume we're right about everything, I think. We'll be back in a minute with Billy Bragg.
Now for a quick commercial read from our friends at Everymatic, the boutique travel company that everyone can afford. The Brexit countdown is ticking and you need a holiday. But who knows which passport queue we'll all be going through this time next year. We know exactly where you should go to exercise your freedom of movement. Greece is the holiday destination for the well-travelled Romaniac, with all the ancient culture you can handle and beautiful beaches too. And you should book with our friends at Everymatic, the boutique travel concierge that everyone can afford. Alex and Stevie at Everymatic will build a fantastic Greek holiday around what you want, whatever your budget. Our producer, Andrew Harrison, has been using Everymatic for years. Andrew, what's the story?
Well, people think boutique travel is only if you're an oligarch with a gold-plated toilet. It's not. It should be for everyone in the free and equal Europe. And Alex and Stevie are brilliant at doing a handmade holiday. They'll find out what you like, what you're into. You know, if you're into culture and food, they will show you Athens for insiders, incredible restaurants, fantastic cultural experiences. If you're into beaches, they'll know the island inside out and they'll find the one that's right for you. They'll build the whole thing around your budget and your ideas. They are particularly good at helping you to discover the Greece that isn't in the brochures. With Everymatic, we've been to Paros and Antiparos, Naxos, Seriphos, places we never thought we'd go, and it's always fantastic. So we recommend it heartily.
I am so booking this weekend, especially because it's raining in London right now. Drop them an email at alex@everymatic.com and tell her Romaniacs has sent you. Whatever your budget, they're going to fix you up with the best holiday you've ever had. That's alex@everymatic.com and tell her Romaniacs sent you.
My mother was half English and I'm half English too. I'm a great big bundle of culture tied up in the red, white and blue. I'm a fine example of your Essex man, well familiar with the Hindustan, cos my neighbours are half English and I'm half English too, yeah. My breakfast was half English, and so am I, you know. I had a plate of Marmite soldiers washed down with a cappuccino. And I have a veggie curry about once a week. The next day I fry up as bubble and squeak, cos my appetite's half English, and I'm half English too. Britannia, she's half English. She speaks Latin at home. And St George was born in the Lebanon. How he got here, I don't know. And those three lions on your shirt never sprung from England's dirt. Them lions are half English and I'm half English too. Them lions are half English. And so's our football team. And I'm half English too. Here's your World Cup song.
We've got another special guest on the show this week. We've been after him for ages. We're glad to have finally pinned him down. He's making Ian laugh.
He's encouraging me to play the piano, which is something that I physically cannot do. So.
Never stop me.
Billy Bragg is neither a miner or a docker or a railwayman between the wars, but he did play them in a song back in the day. He's a musician, an author, a public speaker, co-organiser of the Left Field stage at Glastonbury, and he's just explained to city financiers how to rebuild a society. The 80s way of saying it. In a lecture at the Bank of England. One of his new songs captures the spirit of the present day. It's called Full English Brexit from his new album Bridges Not Walls, and we'll be hearing it later. Hello, Billy. Welcome to Romaniacs.
Great to be here, Dorian.
What did the Bank of England make of you?
Oh, it was really interesting. I mean, they invited me because they're trying to get people inside from, you know, out of the city of London to give them a different perspective on things. They had Grayson Perry a couple of months ago. Huh. And I suffer from the same problem, you know, the classic sort of echo chamber problem. How do you get to find people that you don't necessarily agree with. So I thought, yeah, and there was a few ideas knocking around I had that I thought would be really good to try and synthesise them into 4,000 words. It would be good for me, a good challenge for me, if you like. So, yeah, I took it on. I mean, I've for a long time had concerns about accountability in the sense that I think in the post-ideological world that we live in, when we're looking for something to replace what we used to refer to as socialism, rather than saying it's dead. I mean, the language of Marx arguably is dead, but the problems that he was talking about haven't been properly addressed still. So we still got to find a way to get to grips with them. So I talked to him in my lecture about getting back to basics with ideas like accountability. So trying to bring that in on a number of levels, really, because I think, obviously holding our politicians to account is relatively straightforward. Holding capitalism to account is a little bit more difficult, but I do think we should do that. Tony Benn's famous 5 questions: what power have you got, where did you get it from, in whose interest do you wield it, who are you accountable to, and how do we get rid of you? He kind of developed them for use in democracy. In fact, he said them in a speech against the European Union. That's when he first came up with it. It's weird. I did some research on this, and it was in the debate about the bill for the referendum, original referendum.
Yeah.
But if we really want to find out what kind of economy we live in, then we need to apply those 5 questions to those who have economic power over us as well. Because I think part of the Brexit vote, the Leave vote, has been about people who feel that they are not listened to, their voice isn't heard. We live in a very politically centralised society, but also the economic power, economic decisions are taken, often not even in our country, abroad. That's the problem that we need to face.
A lot of your songs are, I mean, they're individuals rather than slogans. There is a lot of kind of compassion and attempt to understand people that you may not agree with. And in Full English Brexit, you've got the sort of voice of a Leave voter who sort of insists they're not racist, but they're confused by change. They feel that nobody's listening to them. Now, it seems to me that there's obviously currents of racism and xenophobia involved. How much do you buy this sort of the left behind by globalisation diagnosis for that result?
Well, I come from a place called Barking and Dagenham. And when I left school, Ford's was employing 40,000 people. And then probably half as many again in ancillary companies around there. I mean, I was basically, after I failed my 11 plus, I was educated to work at Ford's. And when I didn't want to do that, they literally, the careers officer said, well, here's the leaflets for the Army, the Navy and the Air Force, son, good luck. it was that. So now, what's happened in Barking and Dagenham, because the factory is more or less, I don't think they're even employing a tenth of that number of people. They're not making cars anymore. So the pride has gone from that place. There was a certain pride in and community involved in the car making. And there was also the ability to take immigrants, employ them, and then give them enough money to send them somewhere leafy. You know, when I was really young, it was Irish in our street. They worked to the car factory. They went somewhere leafy. Then it was people from the Caribbean, then people from the Indian subcontinent. That's all finished as well. And on top of that, Barking and Dagenham has the lowest house prices anywhere in Greater London, probably anywhere in the southeast. So when you mix all those things together with a population that was previously really well looked after because the unions were so well organised in Ford's, Barking and Dagenham Council provided a lot of positive things, education, leisure, apprenticeships, all those kind of things. They're gone. And people feel that they are not so much left behind, but left high and dry, and nobody's listening to them. I mean, that's what you probably remember a couple of years ago when the BNP won 12 seats on the council. Mm. I mean, I spoke to someone who was there. They only put up 12 candidates. So as someone who was at the count that night in the council, if they'd have put up a full slate, they'd have taken the council. You know, that's partly a result of Tony Blair saying we don't have to worry about the white working class. They've got no one to vote for. But the corollary of that is that we organised, we got together with people, and then when the next elections came, we wiped them out.
Mm.
And, you know, that's the same white working class. Before we can call them all racist, you know, it restored my trust in the working class, especially when there had to be a rerun because Richard Barnbrook, the candidate against Richard Barnbrook was a lollipop lady, and you can't run for the council if you're a council employee. So they had to rerun it when nobody was there, and he still lost. He was their highest profile guy. So it wasn't just all us outsiders. I don't really count myself as an outsider in Barking, but I know what people mean when they say it. It wasn't just us outsiders. People realised that whatever the British National Party was offering, it wasn't really going to be helpful for the community. So I kind of trust the white working class to make that decision. But I do understand when they say that nobody listens to them. And I understand also when they say this doesn't feel like my country, because in the 1980s, I remember that feeling. I know what that feels like. When your country is going in the absolute opposite direction to the way you think it should be doing, and you wake up the morning after Thatcher's scored another landslide, and you're looking at people on the bus feeling like a total alien. So if we're going to overcome Brexit, if we're going to stop it, or at the very least mitigate its circumstances. We're going to have to convince some of those people who did vote Leave to think again and to you know, recognise what the problems for themselves and for their families and for what they want. But we're not going to do that by keep pointing fingers at them and calling them racist and you know, saying they don't care about anything. They do care. What they care about is people hearing their voice. And whether we like it or not, for them, Brexit was the first time they got a result that they felt they owned. And if we want to get it back from them, we're going to have to find some accommodation with them, some empathy about their sense of not feeling that they belong anymore. I'm not talking about racism. You know, whatever we find racism, we have to condemn it. But there are a lot of people out there who just don't feel they're getting a fair break anymore from the way the economy is put together. And, you know, that needs, definitely needs addressing at the very least. But more than that, it needs something doing about it. Now, it's very complicated. I appreciate that. But I think that's really where, rather than expecting to go back to how things were before with the European Union, which did have its problems in terms of the way the economy was run, I think we really should be talking about putting forward our idea of how the European Union could be different and more responsive to people. You know, a sort of reform and remain kind of argument, rather than just remain. I think that's a sheer argument that runs up against the Leave's sheer argument. There's no bridging argument. And I think remain and reform is what we should be talking about. Rather than having a go at them all the time, we should be making examples of how the European Union can help them and their kids and how we can deal with the big problems in the world by working with one another rather than being isolated on our own outside of all the big decision-making process.
Do you feel things are going quite well in that kind of respect? Do you still feel Brexit stoppable? And also, do you feel that there's enough sort of content to that kind of idea of we can stop this while still having something positive to say to people who voted Leave and still making an offer? I just threw a lot of questions at you.
You did, and I'll try and jump on them. One of the great frustrations about this debate for us is that the Tories have still not defined what it's going to mean for most people. You know, we're really not that further down the line than we were on, you know, a couple of years ago on the morning after the referendum. None of us really have a clear idea what it's going to look like. And until we do, I don't think there'll be a big movement in public opinion. But I do think that whatever the outcome is, the status quo is not an option. There's no going back to what there was before. There's been a break there, like a fracture. And if we want to get to a situation where we still have free movement of people, where we still have the single market and those things, we've got to make a case, a positive case, for a future in which is a lot more connected with people's experience. Again, a lot of people have been talking for a long time before this, before the referendum, about Europe being more about people and less about profit.
Mm. It's often, there's a sort of caricature that the Leave campaign had all the emotion and this kind of sense of, you know, Britishness and Englishness, and the Remain campaign just had kind of like spreadsheets. Mm. But on the day after the referendum, we were both at Glastonbury.
We were, yeah.
And I was having I was just in a foul mood. Mm. And I was...
I remember it well. Yeah. Not your mood. I remember my own mood.
I was at the back of the tent, so I'm sure my foul mood didn't... Maybe it reached you that far. But I remember watching, and you made a little speech about it and played I Keep Faith. And I was quite teary at that point. And all that day, the whole weekend, actually, there was this intense emotion,
yeah,
which perhaps had not come across in the campaign, that
yeah,
it wasn't people worrying about the economy.
No.
It was people genuinely feeling, yeah, like, oh my God, what's happening, yeah, to this country? I wonder whether that needs to come out more.
That was a very interesting gig, actually, because it was the Friday night after the referendum vote had gone down in the morning. And when I went on, left field was a bit like triage for a lot of people, I think, that weekend. And it was one of those weird gigs where when you go on stage... And it doesn't happen very often, but when it does, it happened the night Margaret Thatcher resigned. You go on stage and the audience makes the noise they normally make when you come off. And you know you've got to start right up there. And I did, you know, I think everybody was trying to make sense of it in real time. I was, from where I was standing, and that's the feeling I got back off the audience that night. And my son, who was there watching me, said, "Wow, Dad, I've never seen you do that to an audience before." I said, "Son, that wasn't me. I wasn't driving it. It's just that mood in there." But that's the thing. I think this is not something rational to talk about like QE. This is something intangible. about who we are and what kind of people we are. So in that sense, it's more akin to the Windrush situation, where we feel passionately about the way these people have been treated. And I think we, those of us on the Remain side, need to recognise more that this is an intangible thing. It's an intangible cultural kind of thing. It's an intangible political kind of thing. It's not something that will immediately be put into stark perspective by a rational argument. You must have found that already. Mm. You know, it means something to people, why they voted. And it may be not a nationalist thing, but just a, in many ways, a democratic thing. I voted for this, and for the first time it's happened. We have to recognise that for some people, a lot of people went out and voted before and never voted, you know, so we have to recognise that if we're hoping to win the 20%, 25%, we need to come back and believe in the European Union. But to go back to the status quo will be like the Americans running Hillary again against Trump. Mm. It ain't going to happen, no matter how great Hillary was and what a positive role model she would be, and how so many people, myself included, would have liked to have seen a woman president. If they put Hillary up again, that's been, that we're past that. And I think we, in terms of our relationship with the European Union as was before the referendum, we're past that. The status quo, we can't go back to that.
Well, after the referendum, I remember I was sort of thinking about the book you wrote some years ago. I can't remember exactly when it came out.
But 2006.
Progressive Patriot. There was a lot there about this idea of kind of harnessing the emotion of, you know,
intangible cultural heritage is actually a real thing recognised by the United Nations. It's not something I just dreamed up for your podcast. It's actually a real important thing. And by looking at what they talk about in it, you start to see things that's always been there that you've never really recognised because of the intangible nature, that you've never really, you know. So it's a very interesting concept, and it has very, very deep roots. It's mixed up with the thing that is, I think, much, much more important than nationality and ethnicity and race, which is belonging. Belonging, I think, is what holds us all together as a society, wherever we're from, wherever our grandparents are from, whatever. You know, it's about a sense of belonging. You know, St George's Day just passed belongs to everybody who was born in England and everyone who's chosen to make it their home. And we who were born here, like, think otherwise people where they could have gone around the world and they've chosen to come and live with us. You know, that's a positive thing, including St George, who was from the Lebanon.
But does the left struggle with how to sort of do patriotism right? That sometimes it seems that very quickly you end up in a kind of the land of sort of legitimate concerns, and then it suddenly seems to be sort of pandering. But the idea, which of course Orwell was talking about it, you know, decades ago, it's like it's an important idea because it's such a, the intangible cultural heritage is so powerful. Well, but it seems the right continues to sort of own it.
Well, it's like the way the Tories can't quite really do empathy. Yeah, and when they do, you never believe them, right? Yeah. You never believe them when they do it. They try really hard. I mean, you know, all the Windrush, Amber Rudd, and all that stuff. So, in my case, I would say that we have that problem with patriotism. But you'd think, being the left, we'd understand, because we understand deeply that there's more than one type of socialism. We would understand also there's more than one type of patriotism. Mm. I think of myself as a patriot, you know. I love my country. Sometimes I hate it, but mostly I love it. I love its people. I love its everything about it. Except those bits that get on my nerves. It's like a family. You know, there's always bits you really look forward to and other bits you know. World Cup's coming up. I mean, how's that going to be, on a number of levels? So I think it is a problem. I think the other thing that's really disappointing is for the Labour Party, one of their big revolutionary issues has been the devolving of power away from Westminster to Scotland, to Wales and to Northern Ireland. Why haven't they done it in England? Why haven't they taken England and said, this is our argument, and said, look, you know, either an English Parliament or regional assemblies, I'd prefer that. I think it's a much better way to get... It's a civic argument, not a nationalist argument for me. It's not about having the flag on the Parliament. It's about civics. You know, why haven't they taken that? They have an incredible blind spot about England, and seeing as our Brexit kind of belongs to England in a kind of worrying way, there's, you know, these issues of devolution, proportional representation, they are not divorced from the situation we find ourselves in now. They can't just solve it by PR everywhere, but they would at least open up things a little bit more and make people feel like their voice is being heard, you know.
We've exchanged a few tweets over the last couple of years about, particularly about, I think, the Labour leadership's position on Brexit. And I think you've, if I remember rightly, you know, you've always sort of put the case where it's kind of like they're playing the long game, wait and see. Mm-hmm. Do you still believe that? And if so, is that not the kind of somewhat cynical sort of triangulation that, of course, New Labour was famous for, as opposed to a principled sort of stand? Like, how do you feel about this idea that they're just going very, very cautiously?
You're talking as if Jeremy Corbyn is some kind of saint who doesn't do anything political, and I don't think that's true. I think he's, you know, he's in a bit of a bind. Brexit isn't really his issue. He thinks there's much more important things out there. It's kind of been, you know, landed on his desk. And you've got to remember that he got this gig without a huge plan behind him, like Blair got it. You know, he didn't hit the ground running, as we know. So he's trying to deal with this as it comes. And again, the failure of the Tories to put any flesh on the argument, it's hard to know where to get a real grip on it. But if you look at the sort of things that John McDonnell is saying about the customs union and membership of the single market and the, you know, the changes in European working directives and these kind of things, there is, I think there's clear blue water between what the Tories are now going into kind of absolutist mode because the Rees-Moggs and the Johnsons are kicking off, and Labour's ambiguity. I know it's ambiguous, and I know people are really, really annoyed about it, but if Corbyn came out tomorrow and said, that's it, I'm going to overturn Brexit and keep us in the European Union, all it would achieve is to unite the Tories and revive the corpse of UKIP. We don't want to do that, do we? If we're going to get out of this, we don't need those...
There's an ugly corpse.
Exactly. Zombies around. So... Yeah. I think people, again, I'm going to have to ask people to be patient with Corbyn. I know it's frustrating for a lot of people because they tweet to me about it. In fact, I find myself arguing more with FBPE people these days than I do with leavers. That's part of my problem I've got. I don't want to kick it out here. But I think in the end, what Corbyn wants more than anything else is to be Prime Minister. And the route at the moment to being Prime Minister is through mitigating or overturning Brexit. And it's just got to be a situation in where public opinion moves significantly enough when the real when it all starts to come into focus. And I know your listeners will be saying, he's a leader, he should be leading public. Politics doesn't work like that. You know, Theresa May isn't being nailed to the wall about Windrush just because there were some articles in The Guardian about it. Public opinion turned decisively on her and on Amber Rudd and the Tories. And you've got to put the ideas out there. And I think as when... Because Windrush has been knocking around for ages, but when it came into focus and we actually saw what it really meant to people's lives, public opinion changed overnight in a way that made me feel all patriotic. I'm coming over all funny now about it. But this, I think it'll be the same with Brexit. When we finally do see the reality of it, it'll be like, you know what? This is a cliff edge. We need to do something about this. And I hope there's enough momentum in the Labour Party, no pun intended, but 70% of Labour Party members are in favour of remaining in the European Union. I'm hoping we can pick that torch up and use that, because it ain't going to be the Tories that do that. You, like it or not, we're your only hope. I'm sorry, mate.
He does look quite depressed.
He does, he does. He does. You haven't got an FBP on your Twitter, have you?
No, I'm easily persuaded by a man with a guitar. Like,
can you old music journalists are all the same. Yeah.
It's like, I'm not sure I agree, but he is holding a guitar. So.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, they said that if I had an acoustic guitar, it meant I was a protest singer. So,
can you play something?
I can, yeah. I'll play you the old full English Brexit. My neighbours don't drink at the local or have kippers for breakfast like me. The food that they cook smells disgusting. They'd rather drink coffee than tea. It's true that their kids are respectful. They gave me their seats on the bus, but it's just that there's so many of them that I fear what'll become of us. I'm not racist, all I want is to make things that I used to be. 'Cause change is strange and no one is listening to me. I cheered when our side won the Cold War, spread freedom and peace all around. Now there's folks speaking Russian in Tesco's. It's a shame the wall had to come down. I know some are fleeing from war zones to keep their young children from harm. But my parents stayed put through the Blitz years, and me, I was sent to a farm. Yeah, the sun shines, but sometimes this don't feel like it is my country. But to say so, oh no, I never get no sympathy. Once we ruled over an empire, so it feels like some kind of defeat to respond to rules written by strangers and measure it inches, not feet. We don't want to go, but by jingo, if we can't be in charge, then we must. But don't be offended, dear stranger. It's not you. This is all about us. But it's all right. I think I've found a remedy. Yeah, it's alright. Gonna be alright. It's a full English Brexit for me.
Thank you.
I think I said inches instead of meters there, but no one will notice.
You haven't had any Brexity protest singers covering that with all the...
No, I haven't. That's the kind of strange thing. Brexity protest singers, that's a terrible thought, isn't it? What would they look
maybe
like?
Maybe right now they're writing sort of songs about Remainers picking up avocados and Marks.
There's Roger Daltrey and Ringo Starr.
When you need them.
That was Billy Bragg with Full English Brexit. Finally, it's time to choose something to go in our Brexit time capsule, where we save something for the future that we're going to miss if we leave the EU, or something that we'll need if we're out. Femi, as our special guest, what would you like to put in the time capsule?
Human rights. I mean, right now, the first thing that Theresa May plans to do post-Brexit is repeal the Human Rights Act. The EU is a body that was set up in response to the worst human rights abuses against people that were deemed to be foreigners or others. And the first thing Theresa May plans to do upon leaving that body is to lower our human rights protections, because she thinks that they give too many rights to people she deems to be other. It's historically stupid. So yes, human rights would be what I put in the time capsule.
Time capsule's getting pretty depressing. And that brings us to the end of the show. Thanks to Femi Oluwole. What are you up to next?
We're going to do school visits. I think I'm going to go up to Scotland as soon as I can, and to Belfast, because I'm going to try and get some opinions and vox pops over there.
So when you say school visits, so even if you've got people who are too young to vote, is that where this idea of just getting people to talk to their parents comes in, even if they can't vote themselves?
Well, I mean, we've talked to some youth clubs and people that were 16, 17, and when they do occasionally like class votes, as in how would they vote, it's like 90% remain. So, I mean, and when you see that your kids are like that, when you see that your children are on the side of most economic experts, I think that's a strong argument that you might want to listen to your kids.
Brilliant. Thanks also to Naomi and Ian. We'll see you next time. For our European language clip, here's a bit of Swabbish from our friends on the brilliant Cake Watch podcast.
Liebe Briten, hör auf mit diesem scheiß Brexit und bleib nur drin.
Now, please be upstanding for Demon is a Monster by Corner Shop, and the roll call of thanks to our Patreon backers.
A thanks from me to John Cooper, Kurt Fricker, Martin Atkinson, Alistair Gibson and Tom Owen.
Hello, and a huge thanks from me to Juliana Jolly, Alex Tucker, Joel Evans, March Irving, and Martin Garthwaite.
And finally, hello and thanks from me to David Whittaker, John Penny, Mark Rawson, Andrew Robert Burgess, and Ben Roxby. See you all next week.
Romaniacs was presented by Dorian Linsky with Naomi Smith and Ian Dunt. The producer was me, Andrew Harrison. Studio production was by Jack Claremont. Romaniacs is a Podmasters production.